Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Corporation Securities and Antitrust and Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Groups, was recorded on Friday, February 27, 2015, during a live Teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group Teleform conference call. Today, we're going to be discussing advertising substantiation with FTC Commissioner Maureen K. Olhausen. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. As I mentioned, our expert for today is FTC Commissioner Maureen Olhausen. We're happy to welcome her back. We're going to proceed sort of in an interview format where I'm just going to ask a few questions at the top of the hour to get things started off. But as always, we're going to be turning to the audience for your questions. So, by way of introduction, Maureen K. Olhausen was sworn in as a commissioner of the Federal Trade Commission on April 4, 2012. Prior to joining the commission, she was a partner at Wilkinson Barker Knauer right here in Washington, D.C. There, she focused on FTC issues, including competition law, privacy, and technology policy. She served prior to that for 10 years at the commission, including as director of the Office of Policy Planning, where she led the FTC's Internet Access Task Force. She's also served as in the office of FTC's General Counsel's office and a clerk to a good friend of ours, the Federalist Society. She clerked for David Sentell in the past on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, also here in Washington. And with that, why don't we go ahead and get started. First, Commissioner Olhausen, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Dean. I'm delighted to be here. I should just mention at the beginning, though, my views are my own and don't necessarily represent those of the FTC.
I appreciate that. That's a common disclaimer here in Washington, so we appreciate that and take note of it. First, you know, our topic today, advertising substantiation, maybe you could start things off by telling us all what that means, why it matters, and what your agency, the Federal Trade Commission, does to enforce it.
So advertising substantiation, it's a subset of our unfair and deceptive acts and practices authority. So under Section 5 of the FTC Act, the commission is charged with preventing unfair and deceptive acts or practices. And under Section 12 of the same act, we are authorized to prevent the dissemination of false ads. So disseminating false ads is an unfair or deceptive act or practices. So we bring enforcement actions against companies who make claims and then lack substantiation for those claims. So to give you an example, the claims have to be, we don't go after things that are just puffery. So for example, if you all can think of the movie Elf, right, where Will Ferrell runs in and to the coffee shop and says, "Congratulations, guys, you did it. You made the world's best cup of coffee." You know, the FTC is not going to challenge a claim like that. But if it's a type of claim that conveys the idea to consumers that it has some kind of grounding behind it. So, you know, our advertising substantiation enforcement and drawing the lines in the right place is very, very important. Because advertising is really a critical way to convey information to consumers. So they're typically not reading scientific studies about diet and, you know, other health issues, but they do read advertisements. And actually, there's very good research that our Bureau of Economics has done that indicates that health messages, and they did this about fiber and in the diet, is conveyed to consumers a lot more effectively through advertising, and this one was through cereal advertising, than any kind of government message. So it turns out people read the back of their cereal boxes a lot more than they read advice from the government. Now, if the FTC is too lax in our advertising enforcement, false and unsubstantiated claims can be made with impunity. And what happens there is the consumer is harmed, right, because they are relying on that claim when they purchase the product. But legitimate competitors are also harmed from false claims, right? So either they are their product doesn't look as good in comparison, or they have to spend more money to overcome the general skepticism that grows up about certain types of claims. So it's kind of like a lemons market idea in the economics literature. But on the other hand, if the FTC is too stringent, right, if they apply too high a level of substantiation until they're very high scientific certainty, then consumers are denied the benefit of truthful information for too long. And this can come about in certain ways. The science is always evolving and always changing. Just recently, the government changed its advice on the relationship between eggs and cholesterol in the diet and its effect on the body. But looking back, the FTC in the 90s brought a case against Eggland's Best and against, I think it was the Center for Egg Nutrition or something, some name like that, where we challenged them because they were putting out ads raising the issue that they didn't think that cholesterol in eggs was having this bad effect on, you know, the cholesterol in the body. That's one of the reasons we have to be very careful about not imposing too high a level and getting the idea that there's some kind of settled science that will solve all problems, because science is really evolving over time. And so as new science comes out, we have to allow that to get out, to get disseminated into the marketplace. And so drawing the lines in the right place is very, very important to consumers, but also to the innovation in products. Because if companies can't make claims about the kind of benefits of their products, then they're not going to invest in the research to find out whether fiber helps improve health outcomes or what is the relationship between cholesterol in an egg and cholesterol in your body. I think that's very important, that ultimately we may make consumers worse off by applying too high a level of certainty. And for the FTC's purposes, this is all really coming up in the area of safe products, of foods that, you know, are safe for people to consume, or dietary supplements, things that the FDA would already deem generally regarded as safe, or GRAS products.
Okay, thank you for that. How has, over time, has the FTC's approach to advertising substantiation, has it changed? And if so, how has it changed? And in your view, is it moving in the right direction? Is it positive change or negative change?
So the FTC has always required advertisers to have a reasonable basis for the claims that they make. So if there's an ad that makes a specific claim, what we call an establishment claim for scientific support, so if they say 4 out of 5 doctors recommend X, they have to have the evidence to show that 4 out of 5 doctors in some survey have come to that conclusion. Or if they say, scientific tests show X, they have to have some basis for that. That isn't really where the debates are happening. The debate is happening where no specific level of substantiation is claimed in the ad. And under our substantiation requirements, we say, well, then the company has to have a reasonable basis for those claims. And then what's reasonable? And we've developed over time something we call the Pfizer test. And we look at, because it's kind of a sliding scale thing, the type of product that's advertised, the type of claim, so whether it's a health or safety claim, that would require a higher level of substantiation. Typically, we would call for competent, reliable scientific evidence. For something that is not a health or safety claim, that might be, a much less specific kind of claim, we would require a lower level of evidence. The benefits of a truthful claim, the cost of developing substantiation for the claim, the consequences of a false claim, and the amount of substantiation that experts in the field would require. And one of the goals of the Pfizer analysis is to balance the value of greater certainty of information about a product's attributes with the risks of both the product itself. So if it's something like a drug that could have a bad side effect, we would be concerned about that, or that's risky in some way, we would require a higher level of substantiation. But what we have to balance that against is the suppression of potentially useful information about it. So under our analysis, the burden for substantiation of health or disease-rated claims, related claims about a safe product, such as the food, as again I mentioned, a lot of this is coming up in advertising for food or dietary supplements, that should be lower than the burdens imposed on drugs because consumers face lower risks when consuming those safe products. However, And here's where my concern really comes in. The FTC has been very aggressive in applying high levels of substantiation in some cases. And what they've been arguing over the past few years is that they want to use two randomized controlled tests, or RCTs, standard, which is the standard very akin to what the FDA uses to approve drugs. But they want to apply it to a much wider variety of products than drugs. But RCTs, they can be difficult to conduct. They're also often time-consuming and costly. And while they may be appropriate in some circumstances, using this as a de facto gold standard for all claims, I'm concerned will ultimately make consumers worse off. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I didn't want to interrupt. Were you finished?
I'm finished. Go ahead.
Okay. The use of these tests, the randomized tests, are your views sort of how do they compare to the other FTC commissioners? Are you all in agreement on various points, or are you considered sort of at one end of a spectrum that some other commissioners might be on the other end? And I'm not asking you to name names. I'm just asking about how much unity there is on this standard, either for sorts of products that do relate to safety and health, or for a larger group of products.
So we'll pick that other phone ringing. So I have dissented or concurred in a number of matters, and often I've been the only commissioner doing so based on this concern. And so my concern has been that we have been imposing this too high a level of standard. We had, in fact, one case where I dissented was we actually were requiring FDA pre-approval before they could make those claims. So that was concerning. And then the other thing is we have been imposing a 2-RCT level standard a 2-RCT level standard for food products and other things that are generally regarded as safe. So I have a series of dissents and concurrences raising those issues. Now, the real key one where I raised this, however, was in a litigation that we had against Palm Wonderful, where we challenged a host, our staff challenged a host of advertising claims that Palm engaged in. And as a remedy for their lack of substantiation and deceptive advertising, the commission applied a 2-RCT level standard for the remedy. And they said if they want to make any of these claims in the future, they have to have 2 RCTs. And I dissented on that point and said that is too high a standard, that we will actually make consumers worse off to have this high level of standard for something that was basically a fruit juice, right? The consumer drinking the fruit juice is not really engaging in any risky, there's no real risk from that product. So when this went up to appeal to the D.C. Circuit, and on January 30th, the D.C. Circuit handed down an opinion where they upheld a liability against the FTC's finding of liability against Palm Wonderful for its claims not being substantiated, but struck down the FTC's 2-RCT remedy on First Amendment grounds. And what the court said was that the FTC failed to adequately justify requiring 2 RCTs, and although they could bring more certainty, we couldn't pursue scientific certainty to the exclusion of all else, and the consequences of requiring multiple RCTs would impose costs that would subvert rather than promote the objectives of the commercial speech doctrine, which is to provide consumers with useful, truthful information about products. So I have often been a lone voice in this area, but I was recently joined by 3 judges of the D.C. Circuit, so I'm feeling less lonely these days.
Yeah, pretty good company there, and a pretty good vindication. For those in the audience wondering, the Palm Wonderful, it's POM. They're the manufacturers, I guess, of a line of juices that made some claims about antioxidants and the power of antioxidants. Are the other commissioners, are they taking account of speech issues here and commercial speech issues. I mean, you've put a lot of stock in your remarks in getting information to the consumers and in allowing commercial speech and those sorts of claims to be made, and seeing the connection between allowing that and encouraging manufacturers and producers to do research to improve their products. Is their approach similar? Are they taking account of commercial speech? Are they putting too much emphasis on the claims of the advertisers?
So I think I would answer that in two ways. So recently I dissented in a case, and Commissioner Wright joined me, called Lindsay Duncan, where it had to do with claims on the Dr. Oz show about a green coffee bean extract. And my concern there was that, so Lindsay Duncan appeared on the Dr. Oz show, and he didn't mention a product, and he didn't propose a commercial transaction. But he talked about a scientific study that, you know, had some flaws in it, but it wasn't traditional commercial speech. It wasn't speech that proposes a commercial transaction. It wasn't a paid-for appearance. It wasn't an infomercial. It was a public discussion of, you know, a scientific concern of general public interest, right? Weight loss issues. And our complaint and remedy in the settlement imposed liability on Lindsay Duncan merely for that appearance. Now, he did do some traditional types of advertising subsequent to that that I didn't have any problems challenging because it was very clearly commercial speech. So I'm concerned that the commission has been blurring the line between what's fully protected speech and what's commercial speech. And, you know, the burdens under the First Amendment, you're allowed to place more burdens on commercial speech than on fully protected speech, right? Because we consider it less likely to be chilled, it's hardier, the public interest is better. But blurring these lines, I have a concern about. The other thing that the FTC has been doing, and again, this is an area where I am the lone voice, and we've been expanding the definition of the interpretation of ad claims. So there's two ways that we can raise the burden for speech. One is to say you have to have two RCTs for the claims you make. The other is to interpret claims more broadly and say, well, you're talking, and so there was a case I dissented on that came out just Monday called, Neil, what was the name of it? Mail App Mole Detective, though the official name of it was Health Discovery Corporation and Avram Boris Lazaro, but it came out on February 23rd, if anyone is interested. And in that, these were apps for taking pictures of people's, you know, skin moles and tracking them over time and measuring them and applying the traditional ABCDE factors that dermatologists give you a brochure to look at and track your, you know, if you have skin changes in your skin. And my concern there was that we were interpreting, and again, I was by myself, interpreting these claims so broadly as to say what the claims were suggesting is that these apps were a substitute for going to a dermatologist, and that a dermatologist, that they did as good a job as going to a dermatologist. And I don't think we could fairly take that claim away from a $3.99 app that basically had you take pictures and measure and kept saying, you know, if these look fine, go to your normally scheduled dermatologist appointment. If there are these changes, go right away. Here are dermatologists in your area. You know, very clearly not trying to suggest they were a substitute for a dermatologist. So by broadening those claims, though, to say, oh, it's really impliedly saying we're as good as a dermatologist, then it requires substantiation to say that app functions as well as going to a dermatologist and getting a biopsy. And so ultimately we're going to make consumers worse off because they won't have, you know, what app maker is going to take on that level of risk or that obligation to test their app to be as good as a dermatologist when that's just not possible. So that's another area where the FTC has been expanding what the claims mean, and that's another way to kind of raise the bar for making these claims more costly or more difficult to make.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned drugs at one point, and we've talked about food, obviously. What's the overlap in your the jurisdiction of the FTC and the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration?
So the FTC can and has brought challenges to drug advertising. Drug advertising has to be truthful and non-deceptive as well. So we have occasionally brought challenges, usually just over-the-counter drugs. We have a memorandum of understanding with the FDA. Now, one of the things is FDA has often required pre-approval of ads, right? So that the FDA, whereas the FTC, we don't do pre-approval. So we might challenge an ad after it's come out. So at times we have challenged drug advertising, but that's typically an FDA function.
Okay. And maybe if you could tell us a little bit about the process of these adjudications at the level of the FTC, if they even are adjudications. How does the Palm Wonderful case, how do you go about reviewing that and the mobile apps case that you mentioned? And I'm particularly interested in whether industry gets a seat at the table during the process and what that looks like, if there are competitors of Palm Wonderful who file complaints or, submit testimony or statements. If you could say a bit about that, if you would.
So we do investigations. So staff would go and, if there are claims that they have concerns about as being deceptive, they would do an investigation and see, what were the claims made, and then we would ask the company what substantiation did you have for those claims, and we would review that, and then we might talk to experts in the field and say, well, what's your view? Does this scientific evidence measure up? Is it competent and reliable scientific evidence? Sometimes we do those investigations and often find that things are substantiated, and then we would close the investigation. And those are non-public, and rightly so, because a company shouldn't be subject to criticism or have their name questioned if their advertising is truthful and non-deceptive. If we find that there isn't adequate substantiation, then the staff might bring forward a complaint recommendation to the commission. And often companies choose to settle those. And so we would consider whether to settle, and we put our settlements out for public comment. So people could weigh in then. But in the Palm Wonderful situation, they chose to litigate. So the FTC staff brought an administrative litigation case here. It was tried before an administrative law judge, who found 19 of the 43 challenged ads deceptive, but did not impose a 2RCD remedy. Palm appealed that to the commission, and we, sitting as an appellate body, heard oral argument and then wrote the opinion, which I drafted and had the unique role of writing and sort of concurring / dissenting in my own, opinion. And certainly the evidence that we gathered in the trial, our staff gathered in the trial, was scientific evidence. What do experts in the field say about this? Then that got appealed our decision got appealed to the D.C. Circuit. Palm got to argue that, and there were also amicus briefs filed by other industry members in that appeal. So.
Okay, so the industry members don't get involved until it gets into the appellate court?
Typically. Now, there are self-regulatory organizations. The Advertising Review Board, it's administered by the BBB, and competitors sometimes there bring allegations that, somebody else's advertising is deceptive or unfair, and the BBB may review that, and then if they find some kind of liability, or not liability, a violation, and the company doesn't remedy it, they may refer it to us. And, I mean, a competitor could also always point out to our staff that somebody in their field is doing something that they think violates the FTC Act.
Right. Okay. Well, we've got some people on the line. I've got other questions, but why don't we open the floor to questions, see if anyone else has a question. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for our guest today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Commissioner Maureen Olhausen, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending, then our lines will be open. So again, push star and then pound button on your telephone if you have a question.
Hello?
Hello, we can hear you. Go right ahead.
Okay, great. Yeah, hi, Paul Kaminar. I'm an attorney here in town, a member of the Fellow Society. Yeah, I really appreciated your dissenting from that med app device to detect skin cancer, because there, as you well put it, here's an example of a product that would help the public, and you have the FTC putting that down. They did. I saw that article, and while you were just on, I went on the website, and I see where they actually had some great data, how their method does match this scientific database of showing the clinical images of skin conditions. My question to you is this: is two things. One, I think one company did not settle, and do you know whether they're going to fight this unreasonable order in court? I know it's difficult for the companies to do that. And number two, does the FTC, in cases like this or other ones, at least say to the company, hey, look, if you just eliminate this claim in your ad or that claim, we'll let you continue with your excellent work product that that you're offering to the public? Is any of those, can you respond to that question, please?
So my understanding to take your first part first, that the company that has not settled with us is overseas. So it may be a little difficult to litigate with them, but we'll see. So the FTC, I mean, sometimes we do close investigations, like if a company has made, a claim that's close to the line and they say, well, you know, we've stopped making that and there's not an ongoing problem and, you know, we realize that was kind of where we shouldn't have been. You know, we have prosecutorial discretion and, you know, we should use that. But what we can't allow is for a company to you catch me if you can, right? So we're going to make a lot of unsubstantiated claims, and then once we catch them and investigate them, they say, oh, well, stop, we won't do it, because that creates a very bad incentive.
No, but I was meant more specifically whether when you the staff says to the commission, or the commission says to the company, look, we feel what you've got here is over the line, but if you just tweak this and took out this word, hey, we have no problem. And thereby the company says, oh, if that's all your problem is, great, we'll change that, and we still think we have a good product, as opposed to them making a guessing game and then going and trying doing something else, and you go, nope, that doesn't work, try again, in order to have some kind of a negotiated settlement where you guys work with the company that you're going after?
We do that a lot. So in our settlement negotiations, our goal, and so the way I measure success is by making consumers better off, not necessarily by bringing a lot of follow-on lawsuits. So if we can give guidance to that company or to the industry more generally about where, you know, the problems are and how to avoid engaging in deceptive advertising, consumers are better off.
Right.
Companies are better off, and we're better off because we're not using our scarce enforcement resources.
Okay, so
we do try to give specific guidance, but also we give more general guidance to industry. We actually have a lot of business education in the advertising area to give people, companies guidance about, you know, .com disclosures, or we actually have a statement on food health claims for foods and things like that. Some of my concerns is I don't think we've adhered to some of the, some of those things in our enforcement, but we do have it. and I think it is a very valuable tool.
Okay, I just want to know whether in this particular case, a mail app, whether the commissioner or the staff said to mail app specifically, look, if you tweak this or do this in your ads, we'll find that that's okay, or whether or not the company just was said, nope, nothing they said would satisfy the commission, and therefore you had to go with the fines and so forth.
So, yeah, I think the settlement gives them some guidance in that regard. But my concern is we interpreted the claims too broadly. So it's not – I don't think it's sufficient guidance. So I used to be in private practice and, you know, had to counsel clients. And, you know, having more guidance is helpful, I think. And but we do try to give both specific and general guidance.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Once again, if you have a question, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open at this point. While we're waiting to see if anybody else rings in, let me get back to the RCT test, which I'm intrigued by, and how those are perceived by the industry. I'm sure it depends a great deal on what the claims being made are, but how cognizant is the FTC of the costs of those studies? Is there an average cost? And what does that mean for the, you know, entrenched regulated community? Are they at peace with these because they're operating and making profits? And if so, what does it mean for the new entrants, the startups who might want to, you know, invent the next app or invent the next juice or whatever the product might be, but they're faced with, you know, no income to begin with, and the possibility of an expense for these studies that you can outline for us hopefully here in the next couple minutes.
Sure. So one of the real issues here, and one of the reasons why I have objected to the FTC trying to import an FDA drug level substantiation standard into the food and dietary supplement area, is a company has an economic incentive for a patented molecule, right? In drugs, you're getting IP protection, right? You're doing this investment. You may, you know, when you get a successful drug, you have patent protection on it, and you get to reap the benefits. So the 2RCT standard is an investment that you're making in the property that you're able then to monetize and protect. Now, of course, drugs tend to be riskier, so an RCT standard is also appropriate there. But when you put that into the food area, foods are not patented. Foods are not IP protected. You do a big study on carrots, any other carrot manufacturer or anybody who's got a farm and can turn their production over to carrots can free ride on the benefits of that study that you've done. So there's much less of an incentive to do these studies to begin with. Not to say that they don't happen, but we have to be cognizant as a regulator that if we're applying a drug level standard to a type of product that a company won't have the incentive to do that kind of research on, that's going to suppress information. And, you know, it's good that they do some research, but if we're ratcheting up the level to drug, you know, to a drug level standard, that's too high. And then secondly, the issue about the safety of the product. When we're talking about foods that are part of the safe part of the diet. The other thing is a lot of our dietary advice from the government is not done to an RCT level standard. Those are long-term observational standard studies. Those are studies that would not meet an RCT level standard. There's no expectation or need for them to. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for us to the FTC to apply that. So those are some very important issues. Now, I will say, occasionally we run into products that say, take this, and, you know, there was one called Benefin a few years ago, and it was a shark cartilage product, and it said, sharks don't get cancer. Take this product, so you don't have to do chemotherapy or something like that in place of your cancer treatment. Okay, well, that is a product that's making drug-level claims, right? It's making that type of level claims. If they make those kind of claims, they should be held to that higher standard, and I don't have any concerns about that. If they're claiming they're a replacement for a drug rather than something that supports the healthy functioning of the body, is part of a healthy diet, or can help, you know, ward off, you know, cancer, whatever, through, you know, dietary means, because, you know, the government gives us that kind of advice all the time, imposing a drug level standard on them doesn't make sense. And then in the app area, one of the things I really try to pay attention to is we need to, in this country, really all over the world, expand access to health information for consumers, right, to help them help themselves. And to have an app that can help you, you know, track a medical condition. It's not giving you a diagnosis. It's not saying, don't go to the doctor, here, I know. But it's helping inform consumers so that they can make a more informed decision, giving them information and the tools to help take care of their own health that then can help them identify a problem that they can take to the doctor. If we're applying too high a level of standard and saying, well, that's not the same as going to a dermatologist, ultimately, I think we're making consumers worse off. I think we're reducing access to health information to consumers. And we're keeping these entrepreneurs out of this field for fear of the liability that they may face. So we've seen reports of this already where they're saying your smartphone isn't as smart as it could be because of the fear in the health app area of being held to this level. You're not, you know, taking a picture of your mole is not the same as getting a biopsy from a dermatologist, so therefore you shouldn't even have that lower cost, capability available to consumers.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open while we wait to see if there's another question. I want to follow up on the mobile app thing and the mole detection app, which I find interesting. And, you know, I'm seeing it the same way you are, that this is sort of an early warning system, so the risks are not great. If somebody uses this app and misuses it, I suppose, they might go to the dermatologist needlessly and be told, well, it's not a problem. But were the other commissioners or are other folks sort of trying to balance the proper use of a product here by 99% of the community that would use it against the improper use by the 1%, those being people who would use it in replacement of a dermatologist? Is that some of the calculation going on by others?
Well, I really can't speak for the other commissioners. I mean, what we need to focus on, what I think we need to focus on, what does consumers really take away from one of these ads? Are they, if consumers are thinking this is a substitute for medical care, then, you know, that could be appropriate. But what we have to do is it actually has to be driven by what's in the ad. What is either explicit in the ad or strongly implied in the ad? And one of the ways we can find that out is by testing what consumers are taking away from these ads. And that was one of my the issues that I raised in the Palm Wonderful case, which was we didn't do, even though we did a full trial, we didn't do that kind of consumer testing to say what claims were consumers really taking away from these ads. So I have concerns about sort of jumping over that part of the analysis to say, well, you know, we just want things to be, quote, truthier, you know. QRCTs are, you know, this is truthier than something else, but without an understanding that consumers may not be reading it this way and putting this higher level of a higher burden will ultimately make consumers worse off. Because, I mean, I don't think that my fellow commissioners are, you know, insensitive to consumers. I think that they think they're protecting them against something. My concern is, well, we're losing something there. If we set the bar too high, we're keeping useful information out of the hands of consumers. And going back to the Eglin's Best case, you know, that emerging science that was coming out in the 90s, we now know was right.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The government has changed its recommendation on this. If we were suppressing it back then by having too high a requirement and saying, well, settled science says X, and we're not allowing new science to be disseminated in the marketplace, I think we have to approach this with a lot more humility, that we have to, there may be times where some experts say one thing and some experts say another. And it's not that we say, well, there's only one group of experts that are right. I mean, you could have a reasonable basis for a claim that not every expert agrees with, but that doesn't mean that claim should be suppressed, because we learn a lot of things over time, and sometimes, particularly in the nutrition area, advice changes very substantially. And our regulatory structure and our advertising regulation has to be flexible enough to allow that to happen.
Yeah, humility, the idea of humility is really, I think, a good one here. I'm reminded of a couple things in your remarks. That the blood cholesterol level in the eggs is fascinating. I've read about that recently. I'm also reminded of the movie Sleeper, which is an old movie where somebody who's been literally asleep for decades wakes up in the future, and they're remarking on, isn't it marvelous that we used to think that chocolate sundaes and things like that were bad for us, and it turns out they're good for us. But more seriously, I'm reminded of a recent study I read about. I didn't read the study, but I read about a study where they tested physicians or nurses or somebody tested hundreds or thousands of patients just taking their temperature. And they've determined that 98.6 is not the average bodily temperature for a human being, which we've taken as gospel for at least my entire lifetime. And it's a pretty fundamental piece of medical information that's gathered every time I go to the doctor. So it is, I'm agreeing with you in sort of a long-winded way that some things we take for granted today seem to be overturned by new evidence tomorrow. So.
Right, I think that's right. And that's something that we have shown through our economic research here at the FTC of the value of allowing this type of information to be put out into the market. We did it in fiber cereals, we did it in a study on fats and oils, and that if our advertising standards are set too high, not only does the information not get out, the research ultimately doesn't get done, because companies can't capitalize on it. And then they don't reformulate their products to be healthier. So there's this cycle, right, this virtuous cycle, that if a company can make a claim about the benefits of its product, it has an incentive to do that research and then to change its product. And then there is a competitive response that occurs in the marketplace where other companies say, oh, you know, we want to get in on this fiber thing too. So we want to make our cereals, you know, have better fiber. And that actually has made improvements in the American diet a lot more effectively than the Surgeon General saying you should eat more fiber. Because particularly in the types of populations that are least responsive to government messages, so people who are in lower income groups or less educated, advertising to that actually is a superior way of getting them this important health information. So we need to be very careful about where we draw the lines. I seriously mean it. People learned a lot more about the benefits of fiber by reading the back of their cereal boxes than by whatever the U.S. government was telling them. So it was a really important thing for the public health to set the lines in the right place. And just saying, oh, the highest standard possible will get the best health outcomes for consumers is just not right. And it's a little bit counterintuitive, and people are well-meaning when they're trying to say it's the gold standard, but it's not actually the way to improve consumer welfare.
Very interesting. It looks like we've exhausted the questions from the audience. We still got a few minutes left, but let me see if you have a, if you want to wrap up, if you have a final thought to give us a, the big takeaways from our program today.
So I think that the big takeaways are that advertising is an important source of information to consumers, and it also plays a very important role in spurring competition in the marketplace. So where we draw the lines in advertising is a very, very important subject. It's not something that's just some obscure, you know, argument about, small differences in approaches. It can have big real-world effects. And that too aggressive an enforcement can result in limiting useful information to consumers. And the D.C. Circuit recognizes quite directly and pointedly in the Palm decision. But even outside the food area, where a lot of our debates have been going on here at the FTC, there can also be important implications in other innovative parts of the economy, including apps, including health apps. And the whole push towards putting more information and capability into individual consumers' hands, particularly people who don't have good access to healthcare information. We really need to be very careful. You know, one of the things that we've seen is that minority groups have actually, the way they access the internet, the way they get information is much, much more through their handsets than through desktop information, you know, the desktop computers. But that is really how they are, accessing information about the world. And so it's a great opportunity to get more tools and more information into these people's hands so that they can really use it, so they can take a little more responsibility, have a little more knowledge about how to take care of their own health. So if we are setting the bar too high, we're not necessarily hurting people like me, right? I'm an educated Washington lawyer. I can go see the dermatologist. I, you know, read boring reports about, you know, fiber or what have you. But we're hurting the people that really would benefit from this information the most. So ultimately, it's one of the don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good kind of stories where getting useful information to and tools to consumers should be the end point, the goal of our advertising regulation, rather than saying we need to reach the gold standard of perfection and certainty in science, whatever that means. I mean, if it's settled, it's not really science, I think. So that's my ultimate takeaway message from this.
Well, this has been a very, very interesting discussion. I want to thank you, Commissioner Olhausen, for rejoining us again today, and then obviously invite you back when you've got something on your mind you want to talk about in the future. We'd love to have you back on our teleforum conference call. To the audience, a reminder to check your schedule for upcoming teleforum conference calls. We've got 5 of them. Next week, the Supreme Court is returning to the bench, so we've got coverage next week of 5 different three different Supreme Court cases and a couple other matters. But one of them on Wednesday will be the King versus Burwell case, the next challenge to the Obamacare Act. So, but do check the schedule for the next coming telephone conference call. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.